is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll examine how to keep your kids safe from lead poisoning and learn about the dangers of fetal exposure to tobacco smoke during pregnancy. But first, what are some of the pitfalls to gaining weight after bariatric surgery? Bariatric surgery holds great promise for those obese patients who have not been successful losing weight using countless other methods of diet and exercise to achieve the necessary results. But it's not a magic ticket to sustained weight loss, and statistics show that many of these patients struggle to keep the weight off. We'll hear with more on this are Jessica Planer, a registered dietitian from Upstate's Bariatric Surgery Center, and Jessica Charbonneau, a licensed clinical social worker at Upstate Medical University. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in today. So Jessica Planer, tell us about this. Some people really do gain weight after bariatric surgery. I mean, many people think that this is the magic solution, but it's not.
Sure. Most patients are successful, but there are a few that do struggle to keep the weight off.
So you are seeing some percentage of patients gain weight. When does that take place? Is it right after the surgery? How far, how long into the process?
Usually patients will follow up at about a year after, and if they're struggling, you'll see the weight plateau start then. Typically, it's after that first year to answer your question, and then in the years to come, if they're not, following the rules, as I'd say to
patients. Why do you think this happens?
Well, there's several reasons why a patient may regain their weight or not meet weight loss goals.
From a dietitian standpoint, I understand, but I'm going to have you hold that thought for a minute, and I'm going to ask Jessica Charbonneau, who do you think is most at risk for this kind of weight gain? I mean, you see the patients, I understand, preoperatively to evaluate their readiness for this kind of procedure. And obviously, you work with patients postoperatively. Mm-hmm. So who are the ones who are most at risk to gain the weight?
I think the people that are most at risk are the people who tend to eat for emotional reasons. The way that I explain it to clients or people that I'm evaluating is, the bariatric surgery, whatever kind someone might have, gastric banding, Roux-en-Y, bariatric sleeve, doesn't matter. All of the surgeries help people stay full. They keep people satiated longer. They take care of that true stomach hunger, as I call it. So if you're eating for a reason, but if you're eating for a reason other than being hungry, other than true stomach hunger.
More like emotional hunger.
More like an emotional reason, then I think those are the people that are at risk.
Okay, so now getting back, Jessica Planer, to from a dietitian standpoint, why does this happen? What do you see happening?
Sure. So the patient usually presents to me, and we'll take a dietary recall from them of what they maybe have consumed in the last 24 hours or the last 3 days, and I find a pattern of lack of structure in the meal plan, and most of these patients will admit to grazing, which is a scientific term that's going to describe a patient that may eat between meals over a long period of time in an inappropriate setting, such as in front of the TV, while they're driving, in front of their computer, etc. So to answer your question, the patient is now lack structure in their meal pattern. They also will admit that they lack physical activity, structure in a physical activity regimen. So most of these patients have to really be active about 150 to 200 minutes a week to maintain the weight loss, and many of which don't move that much.
That's more than a half an hour a day, basically, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that can contribute to lack of weight maintenance or, obviously the weight regain. It's really important that I stress that usually at their 6 to 8 month marker that they have to come up with a physical activity plan in order to maintain the weight loss. And last but not least, it's really a lack of self-monitoring, a lack of awareness of what they're consuming, and they're not journaling. Patients in the beginning usually write down and record what they're eating, but then as time goes on, they become too relaxed with that behavior. And journaling, I find to be a very powerful tool to help with self-awareness.
Again, and that's something that's encouraged, obviously, post-operatively.
It is absolutely encouraged.
And the same would be said for structured meal plans.
Right.
I mean, that's encouraged as well.
Exactly.
So people somehow fall off the wagon, for want of a better term.
As a dietitian, I can help with those three entities, but really when the patient starts to complain of depression or a cognitive change in their life, I usually refer them to Jessica, because that really is the other piece of this, is the mindfulness and helping them get back on track with that. So,
are there any physiological explanations that also contribute? Jessica Charbonneau was clear in saying that it doesn't really matter what procedure you undergo,
right.
But over time. I've heard things like my stomach stretched back again. Is that just an excuse? Or in fact, are there physiological explanations for why someone might fall off the wagon?
Of course, there are anatomical reasons why patients may have a lack of satiety or weight regain. At that point in time, we will have them see their surgeon, and the surgeon can take proper parameters as to look to see what
is going
on. To
evaluate if that's happening.
Absolutely. I can tell you just from experience, most of the patients do not have any anatomical issues with their operation, and it comes down to mindfulness or lack of.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here along with registered dietitian Jessica Planer and licensed clinical social worker Jessica Charbonneau, and we're talking about weight gain after bariatric surgery. So, Jessica Charbonneau, we've been alluding to this idea of mindfulness, but it also suggests to me that there is an emotional or a psychological component to why people regain the weight. Is it that some people assume because they've had surgery that they no longer have to take charge of their eating? Is that part of the whole kind of picture?
I think that may be true for a small amount of people, but I know that most weight loss clinics, and this is especially true of Upstate's, they really emphasize with patients from the very beginning of the procedure, the whole pre-surgery procedure, through surgery and even post-surgery, they really emphasize that bariatric surgery is a tool, and that it's if it's used correctly, then people are going to be very, very successful. It's going to assist people in being successful. But if they're not doing their part, then it's not magic. It's not going to solve all
so
of everyone's
personal,
problems.
Personal responsibility is crucial at all phases of this process. But somehow there are some, as you said, who fall, for want of a better term, fall off the wagon. So tell us about that.
Well, I think I usually emphasize with clients that it's really a change, a big behavioral and cognitive change. You have to start thinking about food differently, and you have to really change most people, they have to really change the patterns in which they eat. So maybe where they're eating, how often they're eating, how fast they're eating. I think to some degree we're all creatures of change. We're all creatures of pattern,
of habit.
And I think that change is very, very hard for us. So you're asking people to make an awful lot of changes, and I think that can be very challenging. So, and I think that's where some people start to falter, I think, and they start to stumble, is that it's hard to make a lot of these changes and stick with them. But there's ways to do it, and a lot of people are very, very successful.
Yeah, that's what you were saying. So it's really, I guess, a small percentage who are having this problem, but when they have the problem, it's a real. I would think it would be compoundingly difficult after having tried many, many ways to lose weight, getting to the point in your life where the only option seemed something as extreme as surgical intervention, going through the whole process and then finding yourself in a sense, gaining weight again. I would think that would be horrifying and frightening and very depressing for some patients.
Well, and I think people in that situation often feel shame, they feel embarrassment, they feel undeserved, I call it undeserved guilt, and I think that those are some of the key emotional reasons why many, many people eat. I mean, people eat for lots of different emotional reasons, but shame, guilt, a lot of those really uncomfortable emotions, those uncomfortable feelings, those can be triggers for people. They can cause people to want to eat more.
So it's a vicious circle,
sure,
so to speak.
Sure, can be, yep.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So do you also see other things playing a role? For example, life changes, newfound stresses in your life, maybe some degree of anxiety. I mean, what else do you see in terms of why people begin to change or fall off what would have been a new and better eating pattern?
So I talk to people all the time about how rarely are people true overeaters, where they're just, I mean, it does happen, but where they're just constantly overeating and it's really a sense of, you know, total lack of self-control. Usually what I tell people is it seems like the problem is more chaotic eaters, people who have chaos in their lives, you know, positive stress and negative stress, you know, so it could be, I mean, you know, it could be having children that you have to pick up from school and you have to get different places. It could be a job, a new promotion at work. It could be planning a wedding. I mean, it could be something positive. It could be something negative, like having to care for a sick family member. But I find that it's more often these chaotic lifestyles that tend to lead us to be mindless and get off track and not follow the structure that Jessica Planer was talking about.
I think. Structure with regard to eating, but also potentially fitness, exercise, those kinds of things. So let's get back to this mindlessness versus mindfulness, because obviously the suggestion here is that a mindful person, when it comes to food, will be more successful. What does that really mean? Tell us about that.
So I always say mindful eating is eating with total awareness. So it's really slowing down and being in the moment with your food. So it's being in touch with, for example, one piece of it is being in touch with our hunger and our fullness levels. How hungry are we? How full are we? Because ideally, I think we want to be listening to our bodies and listening for that signal that's going to tell us when to eat and when not to eat.
Doesn't slowing down play a huge role? Because I read somewhere that it takes a certain amount of time for it to register after you've eaten, for it to literally register in the satiety center that you really are full. So does slowing down play a huge role?
Oh, it does. And we teach our patients from post, you know, pre-op day one as they enter the program that they have to start to slow down, that they have to chew well, and they're not drinking with meals. Those are the three basic behavior modifications. So,
So you're helping them with that. So how do you help people maybe not feel ashamed, not feel guilty, and make the positive changes? I don't want to run out of time.
Okay, sure. Well, I use something called a hunger fullness scale, and I have people immediately start paying attention to how hungry and how full they are, and really basing when they eat and how much they eat on that idea of hunger and fullness, really getting in touch with hunger and fullness. I try to help them identify what is the emotional reason that they in particular eat, because no one should have, usually it is an uncomfortable emotion and we shouldn't have, nobody wants to feel that. So it's important they find something else that's going to make them feel better other than eating. And that is possible. There's lots
perhaps,
of other things we can learn to do.
Or even seeking professional
Absolutely.
Help for that emotion.
Yeah. Yes.
Rather
yep.
than just putting
that's
the
certainly
food
one option,
in their
yes.
mouth. So basically what you're saying is if people then run out of, find that they have overeaten and they've gained weight, I think you have a crucial message, Jessica Planer. Yeah. Come back to us, right?
Absolutely. Come back. We are there to help you. Follow-up is crucial, and it is a key component in successful weight maintenance. So we hope to see it, you know, back in our clinic so we can...
So you're not a failure. There's
Absolutely
still hope.
Not.
And
Absolutely
people
not.
Should really continue on their process. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
My guests have been Jessica Planer, a registered dietitian from Upstate Bariatric Center, and Jessica Charbonneau, who's a licensed clinical social worker at Upstate Medical University. Obviously, the work that you're doing with these patients is crucial. You've saved a lot of lives, I'm sure. Thank you so much for coming in. I'm
thank
Linda
you.
Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Coming up next. next, how to protect your children from lead poisoning. This is Upstate's HealthLink on air. Linda Cohen along with you. Lead poisoning. It continues to be the number one environmental poison for children in New York State. Lead is highly toxic, and it's most harmful to children in their early years. And elevated blood lead levels can trigger serious health concerns, ranging from gastrointestinal symptoms to chronic kidney inflammation and even convulsions. And there's a strong link between these high lead levels and reduced IQ and behavioral problems. Joining us to help us better understand these dangers and what can be done about it is Dr. Howard Weinberger. He's an emeritus professor of pediatrics at Upstate Medical University and the medical director of the Central Eastern New York State Lead Poisoning Prevention Resource Center. Welcome, Dr. Weinberger. Thanks for coming.
It's a mouthful, isn't it?
That was really, that's quite a title. So lead poisoning in children especially is still a very important environmental issue. Tell us about it.
Well, it's the one we know most about. There are many other environmental problems. I don't want to suggest that lead is the only one, but it's the one we have the most experience with, and it's the one that we really have, I consider, a public health success story, because when I first started in getting involved with lead poisoning, the numbers of children who had very high lead levels were really enormous compared to where we are now.
So we've done something to actually mitigate this.
Absolutely.
I want to get to how we actually mitigate it, but help us right now. Roughly, what do you think the incidence is, both in New York State and then nationally?
Well, the numbers change all the time because the acceptable level is now less than 5 micrograms per deciliter.
So
now,
at one time,
there's no such thing as a normal blood lead level. When I first started getting involved with it, the acceptable level was 40 micrograms per deciliter. So as you reduce the acceptable level, the number of children who are listed as affected goes up naturally, because there are still a lot of children who have measurable blood lead levels in this country.
So the point is, it's not normal to have any blood,
any lead
in your blood.
Exactly.
But what happened was, at one time they were more, I don't know, loose in their standards, and you could have a much higher level and not considered
I think basically we've learned over the period of years that lead is toxic at every level, and including even as low as 5 micrograms per deciliter, there are potential side effects to some children.
So let's talk about that. What exactly is lead poisoning? What does it mean, and what does it show up as?
Well, lead gets absorbed through the intestinal tract usually, although some children can get it by inhaling when you have an aerosol of lead. For example, if you're scraping or sanding a wall with lead in it, you can breathe it in. But most children get exposed by ingesting lead. How do they get it? They get it from products that have lead on them, and the most common one is still leaded paint in houses.
And that still exists?
Until 1970s, almost every house in this country had leaded paint, outside as well as inside. Legislation passed in the late 1970s limited the amount of lead that could be used on indoor paint. Well, 1970s is not that far back. So if you look at some of the statistics in New York State, particularly upstate New York, 75% of homes were built before the 1970s, meaning that there's still going to be a reservoir of lead for children well into the future. Now, this isn't true, by the way, of every state in the country. There's, you know, some areas are newer communities out in the West, where the percentage of houses that were older are much less. So New York State is really at the forefront of limiting this issue and looking at a very, very continued high risk well into the future.
Yeah, we want to talk about how they're taking steps to mitigate the exposure. But basically what happens is the children perhaps ingest a chip of paint that gets dislodged from a wall or a...
Right. As a house gets older, the paint dries, it desiccates, it becomes like a potato chip to the child. And if it becomes accessible, they may chew on it. And ironically, lead paint tastes sweet. So and you can see how a child is attractive to a child.
So who, besides, obviously, let's run through, who are the people who are most at risk for lead poisoning?
Well, the age group under five are the age group where children tend to put things in their mouth anyway. It's a normal behavior to chew on things, rubbing your teeth when you're teething. And so that's a normal developmental phenomenon. Unfortunately, there are other children, developmentally delayed children, autistic children, who continue to do that kind of behavior well into their teenagers. So those are that's still the highest risk age group. We're now more also very concerned about pregnant women.
Why?
Pregnant women have a variety of, the term is called PICA, which is behavior of eating something as non-food products. These are habits socially, culturally. For example, some women eat starch during their pregnancy. Some women have a preference for chewing on certain kinds of wood. There are a variety of cultural differences all over the world. And if you find some behavior that is at risk, like, for example, eating dirt or soil during your pregnancy, you can have a very high lead level. And there are also exposures during occupations and also during hobbies. So we've learned over the last, I'd say, decade to be very concerned about the exposure during pregnancy and the possible prenatal exposure to the fetus and to the infant.
So the unborn child is going
to be
affected by that.
Exactly. And we really have no information about what the long-term effects of that is.
What other groups also? There are some other groups that you had mentioned to me, that new Americans.
Yes, well,
what do we mean
by
that?
We now in Central New York, across the country, are inviting people from other parts of the world to come to the United States. And so we have populations coming from areas of the world where they have very, very different standards. For example, there's no EPA, for example, in China to reduce pollution.
And in fact, not to interrupt you, but in fact, some of the toys that have come from China have been found to have lead.
That was a couple years ago.
Right.
There were toys that were painted with leaded paint. Actually, that didn't really create too much of a hazard, but it gave us an opportunity to educate the public about another potential source. So, for example, if you come from a country where they still use leaded gasoline, you can get exposed to lead that way. And then there are other issues we learned. Every year we learn about different cultural issues, spices, herbs, home remedies, medicines that people bring with them, thinking that it's good for the patient, for the child, but not knowingly that it's laced with lead.
Wow.
So every new population that comes into the country, by CDC law, the children up until age 16 have to have a lead level before they come in.
And hopefully educate the population.
A, find out if they have had lead exposure. B, to try to educate them not to continue doing the behavior that they had before.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with pediatrician Dr. Howard Weinberger, and we're talking about the dangers of lead poisoning. So basically, the largest source of lead has been paint.
Still is the same. That's still the same source, right? That's still the major source.
What symptoms do you see for lead poisoning?
In most children, you don't see any. And the ones we pick up are very subtle. You mentioned gastrointestinal symptoms like constipation, because lead does have an effect on the nerves in the intestinal tract. But as the level goes up, as the blood level goes up, then additional symptoms can appear. And the worst, of course, are you mentioned seizures or convulsions. That suggests that lead has affected the brain acutely. And that is a term we call lead encephalopathy. You don't ever want to see that, because that has terrible long-term side effects.
But it also sounds like even if it can be a lower level, it can have subtle effects on behavior,
intellectual
development.
Absolutely. That's what we've learned in the last, I'd say, 20 years. People have recognized, psychiatrists, neurologists have recognized that there are subtle findings that we had never even associated with lead levels. And so behavioral problems, learning disabilities, even some children who have ADHD, the attention deficit disorder, may be associated with lead exposure as well.
So how is it treated? Let's say you discover an abnormally high lead level. Is there a treatment?
Yeah, there is a treatment. It's called chelation, where you give a particular chemical which absorbs the lead in the blood and allows it to be excreted through the kidneys. The problem is, as any treatment, has side effects itself. So we try to avoid using chelating agents unless the level is much higher. Higher is an arbitrary number. We use levels in the mid-40s to 50 to treat. Otherwise, what we do in this county and most counties, we have a tremendous public health relationship with the health department, where public health nurses go out to a home and check with environmental equipment to see if there's an exposure that we can identify and then prevent continued exposure.
So let's talk about prevention, because clearly that's where the money is, so to speak.
Right.
I mean, especially as you've outlined, in this particular region, we have so many homes that still have lead paint. First of all, does painting over the lead paint take care of the problem?
Well, that's a good question. It gives you a cosmetic result, because the lead is still there, if it's still accessible to the child, that's not a solution. And that creates a problem, because in order to rehabilitate a home, it has to be done very carefully. And there are rules now for people who do remediation. They have to pass a test, and they have to wear special equipment and special a ventilator for themselves, so that they don't get exposed to the lead when they do that. Yes, you can remove the lead, but it's very, very expensive. In fact, some people say the most cost-effective thing to do is replace the windows, because windows, sashes, would go up and down summer, winter. You create a lead hazard when you're actually opening and closing the windows every time. So if there's one thing that one could do, is really replace the windows and the frame around the windows. But that in itself is expensive.
Are there other things that we can do that are being done, for example, in New York State? I read somewhere that things like washing the floors, the countertops, the windowsills on a weekly basis.
Sure, wet mopping and wet mop is very helpful. One thing that we tend to forget is New York State has a regulation from the State Health Department that all children, not just low-income children, but all children should have a blood lead test at 1 and 2 years of age. And many of my colleagues in practice object to it. They say, I never saw a child with lead poisoning in my office, but you can't identify a lead level by just looking at a child's face. You have to get a blood test. And what that does is it tells us if the child has even a modestly, and I use those terms, carefully, modestly elevated level, you can then prevent continued exposure. So by doing a lead test at a year of age, you get a baseline. If it's acceptable level, great. And then you do it again at 2 years, because in that second year of life is really the high-risk year. That's when the child is mobile,
right?
When the child can
crawling,
reaching up to the wood, to the windowsills.
Right.
And so that's the age. Actually, the second year is really the most high-risk year. So by doing blood testing at 1 and 2 years of age, that is a way of doing primary and secondary prevention. I say secondary because if you have an elevated level, then you can try to prevent continued exposure.
So that at that point, education comes in.
Exactly.
People come in and try to mitigate the home environment.
Exactly.
All of those things to basically prevent it. So that's actively going on. Is it going on throughout the country or just?
It is, but not the way it is in certain states. Again, New York State is, I think, at the forefront of this, because we do have older housing market, right?
Well, it sounds like you started out with very happy news. I don't want to run out of time. Basically, you think you have mitigated, in large part, some of the exposure.
Absolutely. But I just point out, just to note that in 2013, we did actually treat 12 children across New York State, across the eastern half of New York State, in hospital for lead exposure.
So it absolutely remains a problem.
It still remains a problem.
And the point is that the key point to take away here is you should have your child tested.
Absolutely.
At 1 and 2 years of age to know if you have this problem in your environment.
Right.
And then obviously, with the help of New York State, take some steps to mitigate it.
Exactly right.
Well, I thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Howard Weinberger, Professor Emeritus of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University, and he's the Medical Director of the Central Eastern New York State Lead Poisoning Prevention Resource Center. Once again, thanks so much for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine, Dr. William Paolo, tells us what we need to know about frostbite.
as the weather turns colder, we begin to worry about frostbite. Frostbite we particularly see as you enter the cold and the extremities that are away from the heart stop getting as much blood flow as they should as the body tries to keep blood to its vital organs. What we find that you should do to prevent this from happening is, number one, dress in layers. To keep your feet and your toes warm, you actually have to keep your core warm. In order to do that, you want to dress in layers so that the body doesn't start constricting the blood vessels in your fingers and your toes. Frostbite can be divided really into three phases. There's what we call frost nip, or first-degree frostbite, which is really just a freezing of the skin above the extremity. In addition, you can have second-degree, where you start involving some of the fat and layers beneath, and then you can get third-degree when it goes all the way down to muscle and bone. You can recognize frostbite by, number one, a painful or numbing feeling to the extremity that may change colors from either white to red. Number two, you can start seeing darkness if you leave it in cold for very long, because you can actually start losing blood flow to that extremity. If you do have signs of frostbite or frost nip, rubbing is not the answer. Your body actually can form little crystals in there, and they can be sharp and jagged, and rubbing it can actually cause more damage to the tissues underneath. We recommend rewarming of one of two ways: either passively rewarming by moving into a hot area, getting near a fire, or what we call actively rewarming, which is by running your extremity that has been exposed to the cold under warm or tepid water in order to actively rewarm that site. Again, in order to prevent it, the best way is to not expose and to stop the cold from happening in the first place. So wear your gloves in the car, and then when you leave your car, you keep your gloves on so that your hands are not cold to begin with, or your feet are not cold to begin with. Dress in warm layers, and things like cotton socks, because they promote sweating, do not seem to work very well to keep you warm. Moisture wicking socks, wool, and natural fiber seems to keep your extremities warmer. So those are just some tips to avoid the cold.
Next up, the dangers of fetal exposure to tobacco smoke. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm Simone Seward, an instructor in public health and preventive medicine at Upstate, with the Healthy Monday Minute for February 10th. Cooking methods matters. Raw fruits and vegetables usually provide more vitamins than their cooked counterparts, but there are ways to prevent nutrient loss while still savoring prepared foods. Careful cooking with minimized heat and water may only result in 5 to 15% nutrient loss compared to processed foods, which can lose 50 to 80%. This week, try steaming or quick sautéing vegetables and cooking meat over low heat to preserve as many nutrients as possible. You might even discover a new favorite recipe. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Studies have shown that exposure to tobacco smoke in utero, meaning while in the womb, can cause a fetus to suffer lung damage and may be at a higher risk of developing lung cancer and heart disease as adults. They also have a higher chance of dying from sudden infant death syndrome and are at a greater risk of developing behavioral problems, such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. Well, now there's even more to the story. And here with more on this is Dr. Stephen Jungentaub. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Jungentaub. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
So fetal nicotine exposure has a lot of consequences. Tell us about that.
Well, so as you pointed out, there are all kinds of developmental problems that happen with children that are exposed via maternal smoking. And of course, the most severe of which is that these kids can be stillborn, they're low birth weight, another number of developmental defects depending upon how extensive the mother's smoking is.
And a high percentage of women, or at least I read somewhere, like 25% of pregnant women continue to smoke through their pregnancies?
Yeah, it's sort of odd that given all the warnings and the health risks that are associated, that 25 to 30% of women who were smokers prior to becoming pregnant continue to smoke.
Wow. But you also found something else, or at least there were some human studies that that demonstrated a fourfold increased possibility that if you smoked during your pregnancy, that your child later would become a smoker?
So that's correct. It's sort of interesting that these children whose mom smoked during pregnancy have a fourfold higher risk to initiate smoking behavior. They do so at an earlier age, and then they go on to potentially have a higher risk of long-time life tobacco addictions. Yep.
So the point is, this was already established, but then you decided to do some background or some analysis of why this happens. Is that correct?
Correct.
But there's some background to that. Your lab has been involved in looking at the underpinnings of some other addiction. Tell us about that first.
So we've actually have a long history in our lab, and also as part of a larger SUNY collaborative called the Developmental Alcohol Research Center, which is a collaborative between upstate investigators and those at Binghamton University. And so we're interested in this relationship between fetal exposure and adolescent exposure, and then lifetime use of alcohol. And you see the same phenomena with alcohol. It's the number one predictor. That is, prior fetal exposure is the number one predictor of abuse.
To clarify, if a mom continues drinking through pregnancy, the chances are very great that their infant will become addicted to alcohol?
Correct.
Wow. Actually,
they have a higher probability of initiating the behavior. They do so earlier, and they become adult abusers.
So you've done a lot of work in that area. Is that what led you to look at this nicotine exposure?
So that's correct. So the nicotine work is a spinoff. And the basis for doing both of them is this normally adaptive mechanism that works to the advantage of an animal in even humans. And it's, oddly enough, one of the ways that you learn what's good to eat is by virtue of what mom eats and drinks during pregnancy. And it's sort of interesting when I do seminars and talks about this for lay people, uniformly will say, oh yeah, you know, I have cravings for this because my mom ate this during pregnancy.
Wow. So you're saying it's pretty common knowledge that this exists.
At least people,
to some degree.
People will certainly report that, yes.
But you think it makes sense. It's almost the way the species survives. If even in utero you're learning kind of what's good food, so to speak.
Oh, that's exactly right. And so we began thinking about alcohol and nicotine not as drugs of abuse per se, but just as a normal chemical stimulus, something that you would ingest. And there's lots and lots of data for this kind of fetal learning or fetal plasticity in the literature. So we wanted to see if this potentially was at least one of the factors underlying this enhancement of preference for alcohol or nicotine. And indeed, it does.
So tell us what you did. What was your study about? Or how did you undertake this?
So we're using a rat model. Oddly enough, it's not a surprise that we can't actually, you know, do these kinds of studies in humans, because you can't sort of morally give alcohol to pregnant mothers to actually study the progeny, although you can do this with some innocuous odors and stimuli. So here we basically use a rat model because their developmental periods and their behaviors can be very similar to humans, and they express many of the same sorts of intake patterns. So we've been using a rat model for decades to study these sorts of things. And for the nicotine, basically, we give the pregnant mothers a daily dose. Actually, we put this little osmotic pump under their skin. It's just a way to deliver nicotine continuously over time. And for our experiments for the nicotine, we were giving them doses that would sort of give you about 1 to 2-pack-a-day smoker. So not super heavy smokers, but just sort of a moderate smoker.
And you delivered it to them.
So the moms get it.
So through the natural process of, I don't know, is it osmosis or whatever it is, that the babies then are exposed because they're in utero, so to speak, and they are getting bathed somehow in that substance. Is that correct?
Correct. So there are three ways that the fetus is exposed. It gets into the maternal blood. By virtue of getting to the maternal blood, it also gets into the amniotic fluid, right? The liquid that bathes the baby during pregnancy. The chemicals in the amniotic fluid also cross the skin, so there's exposure that way. But most people don't realize that developing babies humans and other animals, they actually ingest amniotic fluid. So they're so they're eating this stuff or drinking whatever's in the amniotic fluid, just like, you know, you would if I picked up this glass of water that I have here. And so there are several routes of exposure.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and I'm here with Dr. Stephen Jungentaub, and he's a professor of psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. And we're talking about his research study that proved how fetal exposure to alcohol smoke can predispose, in this case it was rat babies, but it's the underpinning for how babies being exposed to this, human babies, can become smokers later in life. So tell us a little bit more. What exactly did you find then?
So when we talk about, in the beginning, how moms will eat foods and then and they have preferences, and then that's a way that the child learns to, you know, to sort of prefer those sorts of things, you have to sort of think about what is it that you focus on when you talk about liking a particular food substance, right? And that's really flavor perception, right? The taste, the smell, the mouthfeel of a food source or a drink. So it turns out that this fetal exposure alters your perception, your flavor perception of these amniotic contaminants, in this case nicotine, in other studies alcohol. And so what we did is for this first series of studies for the nicotine exposures was looked at the odor component. You know, would you be more attracted? You know, most people find cigarette smoke pretty aversive, especially non-smokers. So the question was, do animals that have had prior fetal nicotine exposure have this innate, this inborn attraction to the odor of nicotine? Turns out that that's in fact the case. So the aversive properties of nicotine odor, and if you actually smell nicotine, it smells just like cigarette smoke, they're more attracted to it.
Wow.
So this sort of primes the animal to be attracted to something that we know is not good for them.
That they may not have otherwise had any interest in.
Correct.
So basically what it's doing is it's shaping their orientation towards something. Just as you said, if it were a foodstuff or something of that nature, it would make them be preferentially attracted to it.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to describe it.
That's pretty significant right there.
Yeah. And then what we also found was if you look at the olfactory system, sort of the system, the cells in your nose that respond to these odors, that the system itself, when we look at it neurophysiologically, electrically, that the response becomes tuned, right? So so you can actually see a difference in the way a rat baby who's been exposed to nicotine during development in the womb, they respond differently to the odor of nicotine than do normal unexposed animals.
So what basically then from all of this, I mean, obviously what you've done is you've documented on a physiological level what has been observed or shown perhaps on a clinical level before with humans. So what's the takeaway from all that?
Well, for us, it's a very big takeaway. What we have been showing is that there are these developmental mechanisms by which mother patterns of drug use, in this case, alcohol or nicotine, actually can be transferred to their offspring. So that's pretty, I think, for us, very significant. It's a generalized phenomena, once you give some pause for that these exposures have many subtle effects beyond the sort of the really, really extreme effects.
Does it explain in some ways why, for example, alcoholism may run in families? I mean, is there some, especially if it's a mother-to-infant connection? I mean, in other words, if the mother is an alcoholic or drinks excessively, is there some explanation then for that pattern that we see?
Well, only in part. Right. So you have to sort of, I'm going to get a little technical, but you have to separate sort of genetic mechanisms from epigenetic mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. And this is considered epigenetic
mechanism. So what happens is because of these epigenetic mechanisms, and at least we know this quite extensively for the alcohol work, that there are genetic changes in these systems that are important to taste and smell and oral mouthfeel to make alcohol more acceptable. And
more attractive.
That too, yes. And so the big question ultimately is you need to break the cycle, right? Because otherwise, these epigenetic mechanisms preclude these children to have a higher propensity to drink, become adult abusers, and then, as we call it, the alcoholism generator, it recycles again.
So this is really very important because you've really found, as you said, the physiologic basis for things that have been observed in the past.
Well, at least, yes, a component to it. And there are likely other mechanisms involved as well.
Who did you collaborate with? Obviously, you were alluding to this before. There's a larger consortium working on this?
So for the alcohol work, yes, we have a very large SUNY research center called the Developmental Alcohol Research Center, which is a collaborative between Upstate Medical University investigators and people at Binghamton University. And then the nicotine work, which is more localized, is a collaboration between myself and Frank Middleton. And of course, all this work was actually done by a graduate student in my lab by the name of Nicole Mantella. This is her thesis project.
Wow, very significant. And it's being published, or it has not yet been published?
So the nicotine work's already been published.
Very exciting. How long did the whole study take to do?
Approximately 2 years.
Mm-hmm. So this is the kind of thing I think people have to understand, especially in these days with the sequester. People don't, I think, appreciate how chilling an effect lack of funding can be to some projects, because they're not something that takes place over weeks.
That's correct.
They take place over years. So I want to thank you. This is very interesting. Are there any follow-up studies planned?
So the follow-up studies for the nicotine work would be to look at what happens to these chemosensory effects when the animal gets a second exposure. So one of the things that we've shown in for the alcohol is that an adolescent exposure, that second exposure, augments the effect of field exposure.
So it's additive.
So it's additive.
The whole thing is additive. Wow. Very profound, actually. My guest has been Dr. Stephen Jungenthal. He's professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Upstate Medical University, and he's been doing very interesting research on fetal exposure to both tobacco and alcohol. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I hope
me.
You'll come back and tell us any new things that you find down the road in this arena. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hello, this is Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse. There is great emphasis in medical education on teaching physicians in training to listen to and respect the individual patient's story, to allow the patient the luxury of an uninterrupted response to the question, "How are you?" can provide the physician or nurse with a helpful and often essential information. With this in mind, I'd like to read two poems by Sarah Gilbert, a cancer survivor and poet from Wisconsin. Her first poem lets us understand a little bit of what it's like when cancer treatment means losing one's hair. It's called Thoughts on a No-Hair Day and contains both the horror and the hope of such strong medicine. Thoughts on a No-Hair Day. This autumn, I am deciduous. My hair without anchor, loosed with a touch, flies with the wind like the leaves released. I rake my hair off my pillow, my shoulders, the sink, the floor, becoming acquainted with my scalp, cool and tingling, as delicate wisps of hair lift with the breeze. I am shedding like my cats in spring, but now they are laying in their winter coats. This is not their shedding season. Better to think of the trees, branches bare to winter wind, strongly rooted, leafing out anew in the spring. The second poem, we can listen to Sarah Gilbert talk about why she should not be considered a non-compliant patient, even though she is about to disobey her doctor's orders by pulling out her own nasogastric tube. But if we listen carefully, we understand how the routine of the hospital often seems designed for the convenience of the professional's schedule, not the patient's need. As we listen to her, we learn again that the patient often knows her own body's responses. Here is why I pulled my NG tube at 4 a.m. Because the institutional wheels turn only upon doctor's orders. Because I could not bear the 6 hours till the doctor came by. because that foreign presence in my nose and throat caused undue suffering, gripping my voice, casting out sleep, and didn't even prevent vomiting. Because I knew from experience that I was better now, that this pain was unnecessary, because I have learned to listen to my insides, I sent the young nurse out of the room, peeled back the tape, and slid that sucking snake up and out.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we examine the importance of kidney transplants and meet a young cancer survivor devoting himself to a career in cancer research. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, all one word, .org. And if you want to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.